He said that the objections in the United States tend to focus on environmental concerns. Many Indonesian smelters are powered by coal. For some, that means any battery containing its refined nickel is discredited, despite the net carbon benefit of taking combustion engines off the road. Such climate purity breeds inertia and is ultimately self-defeating. And he basically said, without Indonesian's nickel, EVs have no future in America. He didn't specifically address the China issue, but you know it was there.
I think we have to understand that Indonesia has been relying heavily on the U.S. in terms of military and security, while at the same time it maintains strong economic ties with China. And I think China understands this situation. As you mentioned, over the years, we have maintained strong military ties with the U.S. through different exercises, military equipment purchases, and so on and so forth. However, we also have a strong economic relationship with China. So I think when Prabowo became the president later on, I don't think economically we will be much different from the past 10 years.
We have seen the Chinese cross into the exclusive economic zone of Indonesia, as they just recently did in Malaysia as well, testing these boundaries. So what are the political issues that someone like Prabowo has to take into account when he's coming into office?
The China Global South podcast is supported in part by the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg and by our subscribers. Thank you. If you'd like to subscribe for daily news and exclusive analysis about every aspect of China's engagement in Africa, Asia, and throughout the developing world, go to chinaglobalsouth.com/subscribe.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China Global South podcast, a proud member of the Seneca Podcast Network. I'm Eric Olander in Ho Chi Minh City. Thank you so much for joining us today and welcome to the show. Today we're going to talk about the crisis in the South China Sea. And we're going to expand the focus beyond just what's happening with the Philippines and traditionally what we've heard here in Vietnam to look at the role that Indonesia is going to be playing. And I just want to tell you a little bit about a conversation that I had earlier this week with some folks in London who kept asking me about Taiwan. And they were saying that they felt that Taiwan was the big flashpoint in Asia. And this is something that we hear a lot in Washington and in London. And many times you hear people connect the situation in Taiwan with the war in Ukraine and Russia. And they see a linkage there that Xi Jinping is looking at what's happening in Ukraine and then taking guidance from that as to whether or not he's going to move on Taiwan. And they were a little bit surprised when I said, you know what, I'm not that worried about Taiwan right now. And that is a rather contrarian position, particularly in, again, places like Washington and London, where the focus is only on Taiwan. I just don't think right now, based on what we know, that Xi is really up for the task. Taking an island like Taiwan would be a massive military operation, and I think that the war in Ukraine has shown him that moving on large territories like this is very complex, especially if you have to do it as an amphibious invasion. So with that in mind, we don't see the massive troop deployments down to the south. We don't see the repositioning of huge amounts of hardware that would be needed to launch an invasion on Taiwan. And right now, the situation in Taiwan is escalating. The tensions are definitely more severe than they were last year or the year before, but they are nowhere near as dangerous as what's happening in the South China Sea around the Second Thomas Shoal between the Philippines and China. Let me just bring you up to date on some of the latest headlines from just the past few days, and I think you'll then have a better understanding as to why I'm less concerned about Taiwan and much more concerned about the South China Sea. So this tussle that we've been having over the past couple of days is whether or not there was this gentleman's agreement between China and the Philippines, between previous Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte and the Chinese government. And under this so-called gentleman's agreement, the idea was that Filipino fishermen were going to be allowed to fish around the Second Thomas Shoal. And the Second Thomas Shoal, by the way, is this tiny little speck of coral in the South China Sea that is the focal point right now of all these tensions. Now, The Chinese said this was the basis of the understanding. The Filipino government under Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has said, we don't recognize any of that. It's not binding. Forget about it. That has been the latest tussle that's going on. We're also getting word that France and the Philippines are discussing a new visiting forces agreement. Manila's also talking to Japan as well. And this is part of just their new foreign policy strategy to bring in these huge numbers of partners to confront the Chinese. Then also last week, we saw the debut of a new group that's now known as the Squad. You might have heard of the Quad. Now we have the Squad. And the Squad is comprised of the Philippines, the US, Australia, and Japan that are going to join forces together in the South China Sea. And then let's not forget about India. Although they are not technically part of the Squad, they are a member of the Quad, remember. India is also in the mix here. We just got word today that the Indian Navy is going to go on an operational deployment, is what they're calling it, to the South China Sea. So they're going to insert their naval vessels into this mess already. And then just a couple of weeks ago, for the first time, we saw that India exported a batch of medium-range missiles. And it was the first time that they've shipped missiles abroad. And this was a batch of BrahMos medium-range missiles that arrived in the Philippines and can reach Chinese territories in the south. Now, those missiles complement U.S. medium-range missiles that are already there right now as part of the Balikatan joint exercises that are underway. These Balikatan exercises, now that's shoulder-to-shoulder in Tagalog, have really unnerved China because for the first time they've done live fire. They've moved the exercises beyond Philippines territorial waters into international waters in the South China Sea. The deployment of force for these Balikatan exercises is incredibly impressive, and just in terms of the scale of what they're doing. They have about 10 countries that are observing, and it has, as I mentioned, unnerved a lot of folks in China. There was a column today on WeChat by a well-known Chinese military analyst by the name of Zhang Jun, and he wrote, and I just want to give you a sense, but he wrote what I think a lot of people in Beijing are feeling now, that the Balikatan exercises, the deployment of the Squad, the BrahMos missiles, all of this is now pushing the situation with the Philippines to what he called a breaking point. Let me read you a couple quotes from him. "Since the Philippines has chosen to take a side, it must bear the consequences of its wrong choice. Since the Philippines no longer wants to keep the agreement," that's that gentleman's agreement I was talking about, "there is no need for China to continue wasting its time. If in the past our approach was both soft and hard, now the Chinese military will take a tougher stance." So you see in that context why I am less concerned about Taiwan and much more concerned about what's happening in the South China Sea. Now, the South China Sea issue doesn't just impact the Philippines. Here in Vietnam, it's a very contentious issue over the Spratlys and the Paracel Islands. The Vietnamese have been speaking out more against what's happening in the South China Sea with the Philippines. Manila is trying to recruit the Vietnamese onto their side to form this coalition. The Vietnamese are hedging on that. That's not their way of doing it. They're not going to join a Philippine or U.S.-led coalition. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of activity in Indonesia as well. So again, if you look on the map where the 10-dash line goes, and that's China's claim, it goes all the way down to Indonesia. In fact, there's a territorial dispute with the Indonesians over an island chain called the Natuna Islands. Now, this one hasn't gotten as contentious as it is with the Philippines, but it is a highly sensitive issue. And what we've seen with the election of Prabowo Subianto is a determination on the part of the Chinese to keep the Indonesians on the sidelines. They want them to stay aligned with their non-aligned movement doctrine. And so the embrace that we've seen between the Chinese and Prabowo has been remarkable. And I'm convinced it's because they want to try and make sure that Indonesia stays on the sideline. But let's get a perspective on the Indonesian perspective in all of this. We recently published a fascinating column on our site, South China Sea Litmus Test for Indonesia-China Defense Ties, by Muhammad Zulfikar Rahmat, who is the director of the China-Indonesia Desk at the Center of Economic and Law Studies in Jakarta. He also holds affiliated positions at the Middle East Institute, at the National University of Singapore, our good friends at LSE Ideas, and Busan University of Foreign Studies in South Korea. Zulfikar, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today from Jakarta.
It's my honor, Eric, joining this podcast.
It's really great to have you. I really enjoyed your column. What an honor for us to be able to publish it. Let me just read a line from it, which is a good way for us to start our conversation. You wrote that as Indonesia and China navigate the complexities of defense cooperation, the issue of the South China Sea emerges as a pivotal factor. You heard the setup about what's going on with the Philippines. Talk to us about the role that the South China Sea issue plays in Jakarta.
What we have to understand first is that in the past several years, the relationship between China and Indonesia has grown significantly. In fact, I can say that China features prominently in our foreign policy. China is our largest trading partner and one of our biggest investors, and most of the investments from China in Indonesia are categorized under the national priority projects. So China is a very important country for Indonesia. However, despite the growing relationship, there is some tension between China and Indonesia in the South China Sea. If you look at the history of the Indonesia's position in the South China Sea, we have to understand that Indonesia has consistently maintained, we can say, a neutral position in the issue. Indonesia is a non-claiming state, and Indonesia has been trying to portray itself as a mediator, impartial mediator. Unfortunately, however, the China's Nandesh claim, or Nandesh line, which you mentioned earlier, encroaches our exclusive economic zone near the Natuna Island. Despite the fact that China recognizes Indonesia's sovereignty over the Natuna Island, China believes that the water surrounding the Natuna Island belongs to its traditional fishing ground. However, Indonesia has refuted the claim and argues that it lacks legal validity. And in the past few years, we have seen that Chinese fishing vessels, often accompanied by Chinese Coast Guard ships, have repeatedly entered Indonesian waters near the Natuna Island. However, given our growing relationship, especially economic relationship, and many economists have argued that Indonesia is heavily dependent on China economically, Indonesia has been very careful in trying to respond to China's aggressiveness in the South China Sea. Indonesia has been preferring to settle the issue through what we call the second track diplomacy, acting as a mediator to resolve the dispute and trying to avoid provoking any further escalation with Beijing.
Well, that's all good and well until the issue becomes a reality, as it was in the Philippines. So right now, there's only been a few incursions into the exclusive economic zone. But if the Chinese start to move in more and there's confrontations with local fishermen the same way that there was with the Philippines, there may be a domestic political issue for President Prabowo that he has to respond to. And all of a sudden, the question of the non-aligned movement becomes secondary to defending your sovereign borders. And so what happens, I mean, again, and this is not even a hypothetical, because we have seen the Chinese cross into the exclusive economic zone of Indonesia, as they just recently did in Malaysia as well, testing these boundaries. So what are the political issues that someone like Prabowo has to take into account when he's coming into office?
I think Prabowo will face a very big dilemma in responding to China. As you mentioned earlier, that China has been more aggressive in the area, and the Indonesian government needs to respond to that situation. And during the campaign, Prabowo has been trying to show that he is very aggressive in protecting Indonesia's sovereignty. However, at the same time, if China is actually increasing its aggressiveness in the South China Sea, this will have two implications for Prabowo. The first one is that there will be a domestic repercussion or domestic opposition towards Prabowo, because Prabowo has promised that he will take a tougher stance towards China in the South China Sea. Over the past half years during the Jokowi administration, despite the fact that Jokowi has been very careful in treating China, but domestic audiences have been demanding more from Prabowo to respond. At the same time...
No, and I was just going to say domestic politics also involves ethnic politics in Indonesia when it comes to China-related issues. What role does the very large ethnic Chinese population play in all of this? Because those two oftentimes get conflated whenever there are tensions between Indonesia and China, that the ethnic Chinese population either becomes a scapegoat or becomes a target of criticism and then fuels a lot of some of the anti-China rhetoric that does come out during these points of tension.
Yes, the ethnic Chinese has been a very important feature in the China-Indonesia relationship, because since the 1990 anti-communist or 1965 anti-communist movement in Indonesia, there have been a lot of backlash against the ethnic Chinese community in Indonesia, and this was further strengthened after the fall down of Suharto in 1998, whereby a lot of Chinese Indonesian occupying very important position in Indonesian businesses, and Suharto tried to make the community, as you mentioned, as the scapegoat. And the anti-China sentiment has been increasing over the past years. But from what I see on the ground in Indonesia, because we just also did a survey on people's perspective on China, it's not really rooted. The anti-China sentiment that still exists today is not really rooted from the South China Sea issue, but rather from Chinese growing economic activities in Indonesia.
Yeah, it's much more complex and it runs a lot deeper, and there's historical tensions that go way back. So yeah, it's definitely not part of the South China Sea issue alone, but it oftentimes can be triggered and those historical memories kind of get activated. And now, by the way, that's not something unique to Indonesia. These tensions in the ethnic Chinese population exist across Southeast Asia, even here in Vietnam as well. The other day I was reading an article on the Chinese website Guancha, which tends to be a more nationalistic website, and they were interviewing the Manila-based correspondent for Wenhuibao, which is a Chinese Communist Party publication. It was actually a fascinating interview because, you know, when you read the Chinese media, oftentimes you get a much more nuanced take on issues than if you read the Xinhua and the Global Times and just the regular propaganda that comes out of Beijing for an English language audience. And one of the interesting things that this correspondent for Wenhuibao was saying was that one of the reasons why the Marcos administration is tilting so hard towards the United States now and tilting against the Chinese is in part because the deep relationships within the Philippine military forces, the armed forces of the Philippines, that go back decades with the United States military. That's something very interesting in Indonesia as well. Prabowo is the defense minister today. Before he becomes president, he was trained in the United States. He has deep ties with the United States military. The Indonesian military has longstanding ties with the U.S. military as well. The United States considers Indonesia to be a major partner, just the same way the Chinese do, as part of the non-aligned position that Jakarta takes. But this must be a point of concern for the Chinese, that they look at Prabowo's background. He presents himself as being a moderate like Joko, but at the same time, he does have this background that is deeply intertwined with the United States military. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I think we have to understand that Indonesia has been relying heavily on the U.S. in terms of military and security, while at the same time, it maintains strong economic ties with China. And I think China understands this situation as you mentioned, over the years, we have maintained a strong military ties with the U.S. through different exercises, military equipment purchases, and so on and so forth. However, we also have a strong economic relationship with China. So I think when Prabowo became the president later on, I don't think economically we will be much different from the past 10 years, especially given the fact that recently during his visit to Beijing, Prabowo also mentioned that he will continue a Djokovic policy with regards to China. At the same time, we have to understand that his vice president is Djokovic's son, and many people believe that Djokovic will still play a very important role as an advisor in the Prabowo's cabinet, and many of important people. So what we have to understand is that during Djokovic's administration, there are several individuals who are very important in maintaining the relationship between Indonesia and China. One example is the Minister of Investment and Maritime Affairs, Luhut Binsar Panjaitan, and he will still play a role in Prabowo's cabinet. So in this regard, I think Prabowo will maintain China as an important economic partner for Indonesia, at the same time maintaining good military ties with Washington.
And let's not forget that Joko's son is the vice president. And so there's no better link of continuity than having your son in the next administration. So that's something interesting. I'm very glad that you brought up the coordinating minister of Maritime and Investment Affairs, Luhut Binsar Panjaitan, because this week he wrote a very strongly worded column in Foreign Policy that was clearly targeted at the Washington Beltway community. There are a lot of concerns in the United States about Indonesia's nickel business. Now, Indonesia is the Saudi Arabia of nickel. Nickel, of course, if you're not familiar, is one of the critical resources that's used to manufacture all sorts of steel and electronics, but most importantly, electric vehicle batteries. Because of the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act, and there's something called foreign-owned entities, and that foreign-owned entities is Washington speak for China. And anything that touches a foreign-owned entity, any part of the supply chain, does not qualify for a $7,500 tax rebate on electric vehicles, for example. And so Indonesia is highly exposed to this because China is all mixed up in the nickel supply chain in Indonesia. And in fact, the Philippines comes into this because when Marcos was in Washington with Biden, one of the things they talked about was the Philippines joining the Mineral Security Partnership, and Philippines is the second largest producer of nickel, far behind Indonesia. But the idea is that the Chinese are not in the Philippines, so that you can get nickel out of the Philippines that isn't contaminated by any Chinese companies in the supply chain. And I say contaminated only in the context of the Inflation Reduction Act. So Panjaitan wrote this very strongly worded column today that was much more blunt than we're used to hearing from ministers. He said that the objections in the United States tend to focus on environmental concerns. Many Indonesian smelters are powered by coal. For some, that means any battery containing its refined nickel is discredited, despite the net carbon benefit of taking combustion engines off the road. Such climate purity breeds inertia and is ultimately self-defeating. And he basically said, without Indonesian's nickel, EVs have no future in America. He didn't specifically address the China issue, but you know it was there. Talk to us about the politics of nickel today as it relates to the United States, the IRA, and China.
All right, so China is dominating the nickel industry in Indonesia. And there have been a lot of issues concerning China's involvement in the nickel industry. Number one is that the China's involvement in the nickel industry is related to many of the businesses owned by people surrounding Jokowi's administration, including Panjaitan. So there is some kind of personal business relationship involved in that particular arena.
So he has a stake in all of this, is what you're saying, right? A financial stake in all of this.
Right. He has a business stake in all of this. And the second thing that we have to understand is that what people forget about China's involvement in the nickel industry is the huge environmental damage caused by many of the Chinese companies in nickel-rich provinces in Indonesia. So just to give you a little bit of background, one of our nature programs at Selios is providing technical assistance for local governments in nickel-rich concentrated areas in how to deal with China, because many of these governments do not have much understanding about how to deal with China, how to sign agreement with Chinese companies, and so on and so forth. And as so
can I just stop you there? Can you tell us a little bit about what some of the advice that they're giving is? What are some of the challenges? Can you be a little specific about those services that you provide? That's very interesting.
So we provide a workshop understanding, giving the local government understanding on what the BRI is, what is the context of Chinese activities in Indonesia, including in the nickel industry. We are also giving them a context on some information about energy transition and so on and so forth. Because in the beginning, when we provide this technical assistance to local government, they don't even know what BRI means, what the Belt and Road Initiative means. They don't know what triggered China in doing all of this. And then when we went to these provinces, we found out that many of these governments are complaining because the environmental impact caused by Chinese activities, the conflict between local workers and the Chinese workers, all of this are creating issues socially on the ground. And many of these governments have no idea, because when they complain to the central government in Jakarta, the central government is not listening, because as I mentioned earlier, they have a business stake at all of this Chinese investment in many of the nickel-rich provinces in Indonesia. So we provide them training in how to read agreements, because many of them, they don't even know how to read agreement. We create some kind of environmental assessment tool, and then we create some kind of mechanism in reporting mechanism when there is a conflict between local workers and Chinese workers, or when there are accidents in the project. Because I'm sure you have heard that in the past several years, there have been a lot of accidents in the Chinese companies, industries, and many of them are not being followed through. So we provide them in how to provide assessment, how to provide reporting mechanism, and so on and so forth.
And how much of this is unique to the Chinese, and how much of this is also common with Indonesian mining companies and other foreign mining companies? Or are the Chinese particularly bad? Because you focused on the Chinese, but mining is a dirty, violent business. And I'm just curious if the attention is on the Chinese, but it also should be on, say, European, other Asian mining companies as well.
To answer that question, we have to understand, number one, is that almost 90% of the nickel industry is dominated by China.
It's that much? Wow, I didn't realize it was that much. Wow.
Let me give you one example to give you the extent to which China is dominating the industry. So one of the provinces where nickel is concentrated is Morowali. I think many people have heard the province, because there have been a lot of news in the past years about worker accident and so on and so forth. If you land at the small airport in the province, you will be welcomed by all Chinese characters written in the airport, and you have to take a plane from the bigger city near the Morowali, which is Makassar. And when you take the plane from Makassar to Morowali, most of the passengers are Chinese workers, almost 80 to 90%. When I took the plane, so this shows how dominating it is. So that's why, beside the fact that our center focusing on China, Indonesia, that's why we are focusing on how to deal with China. And the local government itself claimed that over the years, despite the fact that we receive many companies from Japan, from South Korea, from the Western country, they never encounter a similar problem to what they have today.
So if 90% is controlled by the Chinese, then it's almost impossible for Indonesia to be compliant with the Inflation Reduction Act. And that might explain why the minister wrote such a strongly worded article in Foreign Policy saying, without us, you have no green transition. But what is going to happen if the Chinese are so deeply embedded in the nickel supply chain in Indonesia? There's no way they can be compliant with the IRA then.
Yes, and back is that not only Indonesia will not comply with the IRA, but the problem is that many of the environmental problems, the societal problems taking place at these provinces are not addressed well by the government in Jakarta.
Are people more angry about the Chinese for the problems, or are they directing their anger towards the government of Jakarta for that?
This is very interesting. When we see the problem with China today is that many of the people in Indonesia are angry towards the government, not really towards China. They do complain about the Chinese activities and Chinese companies' activities in Indonesia, but when we ask, like, who should we blame? They will say the government for allowing them to come in, for not giving them a lot of regulation, strict regulation.
So it just adds to the mounting pressure and this talking about the South China Sea and the mining issues. And so China is becoming obviously a much, much more prominent issue in Indonesian domestic politics. But on the more positive side of things, we're seeing a lot of economic engagement in Indonesia in the form of TikTok with their, you know, their e-commerce platform. Chinese EVs are showing up more. There's a lot of investment. I think that the Chinese look at a country like Indonesia, a country of, I think, 280 million people, 290 million people. I think the fourth or fifth largest country in the world, as incredibly important to them as their world gets smaller in the G7 countries. So it's going to be very difficult for China to sell a lot of cars in the United States, but Indonesia potentially could buy an enormous number of Chinese cars and Chinese products. So very important there. Just very quickly before we go, I just want to circle back to the South China Sea issue and some of the things you were saying, because as you were talking, I was reflecting on this. So, you know, I said, I'm very concerned that this is going to escalate. Clearly in China, we heard from Zhang Jun, that commentator, that he says we're reaching a breaking point. What happens if conflict does break out in the South China Sea? Does Indonesia try and play the non-aligned movement role as the mediator? That's what it tried to do when it had the chairmanship of the G20. It didn't really do a good job because ASEAN also is not a good vehicle for this. There's a lot of frustration in Manila among a lot of key stakeholders that countries like Indonesia are not speaking out more in defense of the Philippines and are not expressing any outrage, and that taking no position is actually taking a position in favor of the Chinese. That is the perception of some people in Manila. How does Jakarta walk that line if conflict, even minor conflict, erupts?
I think it's very difficult to say, because I think when it comes to sovereignty issue, our government is very strong in protecting our territory, our sovereignty. However, I think, as I mentioned earlier, they will face a lot of dilemma, especially when it comes to economic activities, economic benefit that they gain from their strong relationship with China. I think at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, if the conflict broke out and Indonesia does not take response, the problem is that not only Indonesia will receive a lot of criticism from the neighboring countries, but the government will also receive a lot of backlash from the people. Because over the years, as I mentioned earlier, despite our attempt to portray ourselves as a neutral actor in this conflict, domestic audiences have been trying to push Indonesia to take a more active role in the South China Sea issue. So I think Indonesia will remain to be, maybe Indonesia will say something, will be vocally criticizing China, but I don't think Indonesia will take concrete steps like having military confrontation with China in this region.
I don't see that happening either. The column is South China Sea Litmus Test for Indonesia-China Defense Ties, written by Muhammad Zulfikar Rahmat, who is the director of the China-Indonesia Desk at the Center of Economic and Law Studies in Jakarta, Celios, as he mentioned. Zulfikar, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your insights with us. We're really looking forward to staying in touch with you as Prabowo takes office later this year, and we'll be sure to keep in touch with you and to follow what you're writing on all of this, because this is fantastic insights on what is an incredibly complex, fast-changing story. So Zulfikar, thank you so much. And if you want to read Zulfikar's column and you want to join the discussion that we're having around these complex issues with amazing analysts like Zulfikar, go to ChinaGlobalSouth.com and you'll see you can try out a subscription for 30 days free of charge. We'd love to have you join our growing community of readers around the world. Go to ChinaGlobalSouth.com/subscribe. And again, we'll give you 30 days for free, and you'll see videos, you'll see audio, you'll see analysis, and we're launching a new intelligence hub in a couple weeks, but it's coming soon. We're really working on it. Jiho is leading up that project, and it's going to be fantastic. We're going to have a new Indonesia nickel data set that's going to be fantastic, that will complement our cobalt data set that Jiho has made in the DRC. So lots of fantastic things, and we really count on your support. And so once again, ChinaGlobalSouth.com/subscribe. That'll do it for the show. I'll be back again next week with Kobus and Jiho. Until then, thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Follow the China Global South Project on Twitter at ChinaGSProject and share your thoughts on today's show, or head over to our website at ChinaGlobalSouth.com, where you can subscribe to receive full access to more than 5,000 articles and podcasts. Once again, that's ChinaGlobalSouth.com.